Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Tom Lucy Plus One, the podcast. For those of you who don't know, I'm Tom Lucy, I'm a comedian, and this is a show where I chat to different people from the world of entertainment. And this week, I'm talking to one of my best friends, really, in and out of the industry. It's Shappy Corsandi. Shappy is amazing comedian and writer, and I've known her for years. One of the first tour that I ever did, I supported Shappy on tour when I was about 18 or 19 years old. We went all over the country for 4 or 5 months together, and I think she's amazing. And we recently sat down in her kitchen and had a chat, a really sort of revealing, frank conversation, which I think is you're going to really enjoy. So here we go. Without any further ado, this is the amazing Shappy Corsandi.
Can you still hear me if I get a glass?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Do you want some water?
Yes, please.
I am very
But you are like though. A really young, like a, I don't know what the phrase is. You're like a youthful, older person. You're very young for your age. You've still like got loads of energy and want to do things. And it's odd that most people your age aren't like that. You must know that.
I know.
Thank you.
I do hear that a lot.
Yeah.
But I'm the same with you. I don't think of you as my very young friend. Like, I don't hang out with any old 21-year-old.
No.
Early 20s. I've got a few friends. You met Taylor.
Yeah.
Because I remember when I was 20-something and some of my friends had older friends, or they had, like, some of the lecturers at uni were their actual mates. I was like, oh, my God, it's amazing. Your friend's 30. Yeah. That's amazing. Because perhaps I was emotionally less mature. I think that helps, being... Just still being baffled by things and still throwing yourself into situations of high risk.
Yeah.
I think is a way to stay young, whether that's work or relationships or friendships, or just do, you know, just put yourself in jeopardy and trust that things will work out, I think is quite a useful thing. Being impulsive.
Yeah.
Keeps you young. Impulsive and irresponsible.
I think there's also like an element of like maintaining your sort of curiosity about things.
Yeah.
Like you would like sort of genuinely interested in a lot of things and you want to know about. I think when you lose that, that's when you sort of become really close-minded and older and
that, yeah,
and you stop wanting to know things. And
you see that happening to people in their late 20s sometimes. Yeah. They go, okay, I've learned everything I want to learn. Thank you very much.
Exactly, yeah.
I've figured out what shape my world is going to be, and that's me done, thank you. And everything else is wacky now.
Yeah.
That happens. Thank fuck.
Did that happen to a lot of your friends who you've grown up with?
Yeah, you do. And then you see them, like, I'm really excited about Friday. It's my birthday and I've got a show in Winchester, and that's where I went to university. And I see the people from university, and I see still the 20-year-olds in them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of fun, and that's nice, and that's kind of the reason why they're coming to uni, they come into this sort of reunion, because I live my life like that every day.
Yeah.
But I think for some people, they do get locked in an adult life, and then you see them come out of themselves and shed that a bit and be a bit more honest with you. And I think that's the thing that goes, honesty. We grow up and somehow we build our families, we build our, you know, work personas. And then sometimes people are taken aback when they're reminded of, you know, when they used to be more open and more honest and risk-taking and made themselves more vulnerable. I think that's the thing, when people are grown-ups or they are behaving like grown-ups, all they're doing is hiding their vulnerability. Whereas I don't have any problem with that.
But it's weird because I think it's slightly easier if you're in an industry like we are, where your job is kind of to have fun, so you never lose that sense of having fun, because that is, but for people who, I don't know, go into finance, or you could very easily lose all sense of fun, or I think we sort of, I feel like I take it for granted a bit how fun this job is.
I never take it for granted, because I made a promise to myself. When I was 10, I decided that no, childhood is the best place to be in, because you get to play.
Yeah.
And I swore that whatever happened, I would get paid to play. And I would never forget what it's like to be a kid. Now, I don't mean like wetting yourself and being a twat. Not that I'm saying all kids are twats, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I don't mean all of that stuff, but I just mean being able to be free and say the first thing that comes into your head and to have fun and to live every single day differently to the day before, which is what kids do. They're so in the present.
Yeah.
If I try and talk to my 5-year-old about yesterday, she's like, she's got no time for yesterday.
Yeah.
What are you even talking about yesterday for? Here's what's happening right now.
Yeah.
And it's a battle to hang on to that feeling, you know. It takes a lot of resistance against conformity. I'm lucky because my family aren't conventional.
Like
I talk to my dad and my brother and my mum, and, you know, I can talk to them about mad things. Do you know, the other day I found out that an old family friend of ours, he's in his 60s now. She is in her 60s now. And she has transitioned to a new, you know, an identity that is her true self. Right? So I said to my parents,
What, she's become a man?
We knew her as a man. But
now she's a woman.
Well, she's always been a woman.
I see.
You've got to be very careful about your language here, Tom. I can't believe I'm more right on than you are. Listen, I think, do you know what I think about the trans thing? I think it's perfectly okay to stumble around in the dark for a bit with your language. Because we can't, we don't all come out and go, yes, I know exactly.
No one tells you what the right phrasing is.
I know. And you just kind of think, I need people to take it for granted that I'm not out to upset anyone. So if I accidentally say he or say the wrong thing, please don't troll me on Twitter. I am learning, as we all do with everything. Jesus, you know, when I was a kid, we used to, we used to say half caste. That's mental, saying half caste. Can you imagine?
I still have members of my family that say things like that.
Oh, I think I've still got family. But so I told my parents, oh, do you remember, you know, your mate, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I said, she is now a woman and no longer this person that we knew the name of. Expecting, kind of telling my parents because I kind of wanted to see their reaction.
Yeah.
And my dad said, what? Because he knew this guy, like they got married in our house and everything.
Yeah.
He's now a woman. I was like, yeah. And my dad said, we are understanding so much now. My mum said, poor thing. All those years of suffering.
Yeah.
And thank goodness now. And I was like, who are you people? You're not meant to...
You've got incredibly liberal parents for like...
Is that being liberal though? Your mom's,
Your mum sounds very liberal. She's saying poor thing.
Yeah, well, my mum read a book in Farsi about trans... that was written by a trans woman.
Yeah.
And one of her very close friends is trans, and I think that's what led her to this book. So she read this book years ago.
Your mum knows a lot of trans people.
She does, yeah.
Do you think it might be something to do with your mum? It's making him object.
Maybe. But no, she read this book and she was like, Shappy, I was crying all the way through. You have no idea what these people go through.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've got parents who are very I don't know if it's liberal or moving with the times. They move with the times.
You sort of grew up in quite a sort of arty, liberal house, didn't you?
Oh, bohemian.
Yeah. Your dad was a comedian.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was your mum?
Florist, but like spiritually she's a singer.
Singer slash
teacher.
Yeah.
In the olden days.
Yeah.
Tom.
Yeah.
The olden days. When we got school textbooks.
Yeah.
You had to cover them with wrapping paper.
Right.
To protect the cover. Did you do that at school?
What do you mean?
Well, you got a textbook, and in order to protect the cover, you covered it in... you stuck wrapping paper.
Why?
To protect the cover. Because it was...
Isn't the idea of the cover to protect the book?
Well, no, because they weren't paperback. They weren't hardbacks, they were paperbacks. Oh, and right. Kids would doodle on them of that. So to protect them for future generations of... I can't believe Alexa's got in on
Your
this.
Alexa's going mad.
Anyway, so then, because image is everything when you're at school, teenager, sadly, people would cover it up and cool, the cool kids would get cool wrapping paper.
Yeah.
The kids whose parents were more frugal would wrap it up with like off cuts of
newspaper.
Wallpaper. The one kid had wood chip on her science book.
Tin foil.
Yeah. Now, the worst thing in the 80s to be accused of was being poor.
Yeah.
And you didn't go into Oxfam because people would mock you for being a tramp and poor. And the irony is, I went to a school with lots of kids from really poor backgrounds, and it was though. But everyone had to pretend they weren't poor.
Mm.
My dad got my book, and he covered it in newspaper. Which was like, oh my God, you haven't got money for wrapping paper.
The worst of the worst.
You tramp. And I just suffered every time I had to hand in my notebook.
Yeah.
Because everyone thought it was newspaper and I was called a tramp. But my dad...
Trampy called Sandy.
I mean, he didn't have any money, fair enough.
Yeah.
But also he was like, but this is artistic.
Yeah.
You know, it is beauty newspapers, it is the media. It means something. We learn from news And you're, and I'm like, I am 13, dude. Just put some fucking pink sparkly shit on that. And then like some years later, went to some shop and they had wrapping paper, glossy wrapping paper in newsprint. My dad had to bring up, you remember? You thought it was trampy and now people are making money from my idea. Yeah, I'm like, oh, fuck off. Like, we had carrier bags instead of school bags.
Your dad was really successful, wasn't he? He was a comedian.
Yeah, but poor. I mean,
so he wasn't well paid, but he was really famous, wasn't he?
Well, when as a poet, you don't make much money when you leave the country that you're a poet.
Is that a poet rather than comedian? I thought.
Yeah. He did stand up much later on. He did stand up when I was an adult, and that was like accident. Yeah.
Okay.
But he wrote. He did performance once I was 20. So.
Yeah. That's what I, if I have a gig that goes badly, I just call myself a poet rather than a comedian.
Do you really?
I'm not actually a comedian, I'm a poet, it's just performance poetry. It's not supposed to be funny.
Do you still die on stage?
I don't die. Well, I do die sometimes, but it's not as bad as it used to be.
Bad gigs
change, don't they?
Yeah.
Your definition of a bad gig changes, I think, the longer you... A bad gig at the beginning is like being booed off stage.
Yeah.
Now it's sort of changed a little bit.
Yeah, just...
You must not die anymore.
I don't die like that anymore, only because I've got the experience to acknowledge it and fix it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the trick, is to acknowledge it, to break the tension. That's all it is.
I don't know. I'm sort of not sure what the right thing is. Because some people will tell you, if you're having a bad gig, to just admit, say to the audience that it's going badly and have a laugh about it.
Mm.
And some people will tell you to just... acts like you're smashing it, because sometimes they don't know that it's going badly, and it's only when you mention that it's going badly that they all go, oh, is it going badly? We thought it was quite all right.
Oh, really?
I've heard from loads of different people both of those arguments. I don't really know which one to...
I think it depends on the gig. Sometimes people know their club, they know their audience, and they know they're a bit like po-faced and a bit quiet or whatever, and they just enjoy, they enjoy it,
yeah,
but they won't laugh.
Yeah.
You get that from her.
Do you have tour shows that are like that, where people are just quite happy to sit back and listen?
No, never. No, I'm not happy if they just sit back and listen. Oh, God, no, there's nothing worse than an audience listening.
If you do, because you tour a lot, you must sometimes get audiences that are quieter and...
Sometimes it depends on the day of the week.
Yeah.
You know. And sometimes if they're... They can be a bit taken aback by rude stuff.
Yeah.
I feel that sometimes. But it's really good. Since I did I'm a Celebrity, the demographic, the size of my audience is the same, but the demographic is more working class.
Yeah.
And it's so much more fun.
Yeah.
So much more fun. People who, have just come for a laugh.
Mm.
And it's fun. Whereas I think that's, especially because of this work that I did before, stuff that I used to do before that I thought, oh, I better do this because I'm Iranian, I better talk about that endlessly.
I'm
boring myself, witless, let alone anybody else. And some people go, oh, let's see what she has to say. I like her opinions on stuff, and I don't. I just want to have a
quite
laugh.
Quite like a Radio 4 crowd.
Yeah, which is great too. Don't get me wrong. Please, Radio 4 crowd, keep coming, keep coming. But... I don't know. Do you know Bradley Walsh?
Yeah.
I love Bradley Walsh.
Yeah,
he's really clever. I've done his show a couple of times on telly, The Chase. He's really clever, really funny, and he gets it, and he gets why he does it, and he's just like really joyous. And I would love the people that like him to come and see me too, because I think I'm much more ridiculous than I'm given credit for. And the way I'm reviewed is all like, reviewers always expect me to be imparting some sort of knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
And like doing something, I remember I got a review once and it said I was willfully apolitical. It's like, oh, you prick. It's a comment, it's a fuck off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Willfully apolitical. Don't put me in a... Do you know what I find? Can I go on a rant?
Yeah, go for it.
Right, okay. Comedy reviewers. I never talk about, the industry being too white or anything. The only thing too white and too middle class about the comedy industry is the fucking reviewers.
Yeah.
Who absolutely can't see past the end of their own nose.
Yeah.
They know what they like, and they like their audience. Like, they don't respect comedy audiences who are not university educated.
Mm.
Therefore, they don't respect comedians who pull in audiences who aren't like that. They've sort of created this, and I'm so thankful for social media and YouTube and people pulling in their own audiences, because it's sort of, it's made reviewers much less important.
Yeah.
Like, you know, no one really...
I think comedy reviewers are really, like, sort of inane, and makes no sense to review a comedy show.
They haven't worked out how to review either. I don't think they've worked out how to do it. And
do you think they have much because obviously, like, in the industry and amongst comedians, we all talk about reviews and stuff, but I don't think with the general public they've got any influence. Or
what I find adorable is when friends of mine say, oh, your Edinburgh show got great reviews. I've even heard radio presenters interview me going, oh, you've had rave reviews.
Yeah.
And all they've read is the publicity blurb that I wrote myself. Back once again with her unique
to critically acclaimed show.
I got the right hump once about a review, and it wasn't even for me. It was for, can I say names?
Yeah.
Fuck it, right, okay. I saw a review for Paul Chowdhury.
Yeah.
Who I have worked with since I was a baby.
Mm.
And I've seen how hard he's worked, how I've seen how he does his thing. He can only be himself. He doesn't try and mould himself into what he feels the industry wants him to be. He is who he is, right? Yeah. And after years of being derided by people, critics, he's now doing amazingly. Like, he sold out Wembley. He's did like a million Apollos in London. He does 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 seater theatres everywhere, right? So I read a review of his show that I was at.
Yeah.
I was at that show. He took the roof off, right? Yeah. He took the roof off, and it got, I think it got 1 star.
Mm.
And the review was so blatantly snooty about his audience, because that particular one was in a predominantly Asian area in London, and his audience were predominantly Asian.
Yeah.
And the reviewer did not count them as a legitimate response.
Yeah. To it's comedy. Not like legitimate success, is it?
Yeah, that's not legitimate success.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've heard people say, oh, but his audience are Asian, aren't they? And these are people who, you know, are left-leaning, would stand up against hatred at the drop of a hat, but they can't understand that what they're doing is taking away legitimacy of someone's success, because their demographic is different. And it's that thing, and that is massively built by reviewers, sort of deciding that, no, this is what we want comedy to be. Anything outside of that, it gets 1 star.
It's also... I kind of feel
I've got to butt in. The reason I'm going on about critics at the moment is that last night I had this mad fucking dream that I fell in love with this critic that gave Paul Chowdhury a 1 star review, and it really distressed me. This dream, I woke up, I've never been so happy to wake up in my life. So I think that's why it's on my mind. I don't normally obsess about this. Can you keep that in? I don't normally obsess about this.
It's weird. I kind of feel like anything that's mainstream and successful is not going to be well. I can't really think of. It's very rare that someone is hugely popular and sells out massive places and is also critically acclaimed.
Yeah,
those two things don't really go together. And who cares?
And that's why you've got to keep your ego in check.
Do you read your reviews?
Never. Not even the good ones.
Do you actually not?
I actually don't.
Because I know a lot of people say they don't.
No, I really...
How could you not, though? Because like in Edinburgh last year, I said at the beginning I wasn't going to read any. And then what they do is they tag you in tweets about it.
Oh, I block them. Someone reviewed me recently.
How could you not click on it if they tag you?
No, because I'm old. Because I've learnt not to. I've learnt not to.
I can't help it.
You can't, but you know what? One day you might. But...
Yeah, when the hate gets too much.
I think... Someone reviewed me recently and added me in, and I immediately blocked them because I thought, that's the equivalent. Why would I want to put my... I don't know the reviewer. I don't respect them. I don't know them. So I've got certain people that I ask to come to, and I know the flaws in my shows. I know the flaws, you know. I know, because I know what they're looking for, I know that I don't fit that mould at the moment.
Yeah.
Right. So they can't tell me anything I don't know. I know the jokes that I haven't mined enough. I know the jokes that I'd already done for my last show. I know the jokes that I'm clearly enjoying more than the audience. I know when I'm relying more on, you know, chutzpah than the mechanics.
Yeah.
I know that. I know that.
It's not a great word, that, chutzpah.
It's a great word.
Yeah.
I don't use it enough. So I block them.
Yeah.
And I don't look at them because I think I've got people who are really honest that I really respect and see a lot of comedy to ask to come and see my shows.
Mm.
And they can tell me, like, that was lame. What the fuck was that?
Yeah.
And I listen.
Yeah.
I just don't need to... And that's why you need to keep your ego in check, because what they're hurting is your ego and not yourself.
Yeah.
And to separate those two things, I think, is very important in order not to go fucking mental in this industry.
It's weird. I remember, like, doing gigs for... I don't know if I should name them, but, like, a really successful comedian... And sitting backstage with him and him listening to him fret about some bad review he got like 2 days ago. And I was like, I was like, why do you care? You like the most successful comedian in the world. Why? Well, you're sitting here fretting about what one man's written in a, and you saw, and it really made me realize like, oh, that never goes away. No matter how successful you become, people are always like, hurt by,
but then
one person's opinion.
But then perhaps the reason he's so successful,
yeah,
is because he's obsessive about it.
Yeah.
So you don't become a multimillionaire from comedy without being pretty obsessive about it. And
yeah.
Not leaving any stone unturned and going over and over your material and
yeah,
pouring everything like that into it. So it's got to hurt.
Yeah.
So I actually understand that more than someone at my level freaking out.
I guess so, yeah. I guess. Because
I'm very aware that, particularly as I've got older, and fucking hell, particularly since I did I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and looking at my life, just going, what the hell am I chasing? What am I chasing? What the fuck am I chasing? And thinking that, like, my happiness lies in my peace of mind. Because, you know, I've got two kids that I'm raising single-handedly, and they are joyous, and they are fun, and everything's about making our lives today as happy as possible. And so my reading a review that's been a dick to me or snobby or scathing or whatever, it's not going to enhance my day in any way.
Yeah.
And my day being glorious is more important than being considered the best thing ever. And I think when you are at the top of your tree, people don't want to build you up. I think in this country, we do have in our culture the whole sort of tall poppy syndrome thing.
Yeah.
Of course they're going to tear you down when you're at the top, because you're selling out anyway. And that writer has nothing. That reviewer has nothing. Has no voice.
Mm.
Has no adoring fans.
Yeah.
Has no one sending you gifts for their children when they have new children. Like, I had... Like, when my baby was born, I mean, I'm really minor success compared to a lot of other people, but the sweetest thing was strangers were sending gifts to my kids that had been to my show.
It's like a princess being born.
It was adorable. I mean, when I say that, I mean, maybe five gifts, but that's...
No, like, it's still cool, though.
It was adorable, and that's like, oh, my God, that's like, you've just given me love.
Yeah.
That's what you've given me. You've given me love because you've... This is... I'm going to get emotional now, but I've given you love at my show.
Yeah.
And you've given me love back, and it's all about love. And the critics don't give out love, and they don't get love.
Yeah.
And they're sort of sad. I think that's a sad thing.
Yeah.
And so they attack people because it's their way of feeling like they matter. And there's some critics who really care passionately about comedy, and they get it. Mm. Those are different, but... Tell this chap not to fret.
No.
And just enjoy his £5 million house.
Do you still, like, now, compared to when you started stand-up, do you enjoy it as much as you did when you started?
Or more or less? I never enjoyed it. Oh my God, are you kidding me? I never enjoyed it.
When you started?
Oh, I was born of anxiety. Are you kidding me? It was horrible. Like,
How old were you when you started?
I was 23.
Okay.
I was 23 when I started, and I didn't enjoy, like, when I talked to you, when we went on tour together, and you kept, whenever I said about a gig you'd done, you said, yeah, it was really fun, and you used the word fun a lot, and I feel so envious, because that's the last way I would have just described my gigs. I was awful for such a long time. I was promising, but so erratic, because I was a mess. I was, like, drinking too much, and I was one to watch for about 15 years.
Yeah.
I was a mess.
From the age of like 23 to about what age?
33.
Right, about 10 years.
Yeah.
Was that, were you 33 when things started to go well?
Yeah.
I thought it was way before that.
No.
Really?
I was 33. I remember 33, I was pregnant.
Yeah.
Heavily pregnant, and I got the coach to my gig in Bristol because I couldn't afford the train.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't get any telly or anything, or any radio, nothing. I did odd bits of telly when they wanted someone to come talk about immigration. I was like the immigrant girl. I remember having a really robust argument with, Oliver Letwin?
Who's that? Oliver Letwin?
Oliver Letwin, Tory, okay. Anyway. I was like, what the fuck am I doing? I'm meant to be a comedian. I'm having an argument with someone about immigration on television. This is no good.
Yeah.
Like Fiona Bruce was there and... what the fuck? This is not the direction I want to be going in. And but then I thought, oh, well, if people want me to do that, maybe I'll do more of that then.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of sort of that sort of stuff, and I kind of wish I'd had the confidence to just be silly early. I think I hung myself on a hook massively, talking about the Middle East a lot and being Iranian. But when you're young, you do navel gazer, don't you? You do.
Yeah.
I had genuine identity issues and... Whatever. But then I, you know this, I went into recovery for addiction in my early 30s, and that's what changed for me. Like, and then it became fun.
What was it that happened during that changed everything?
Well, when you are... It just took my anxiety away. I just regularly spoke to people about my anxiety and my addiction, and it went away.
Yeah.
And then when that goes... life happens.
Yeah.
Life happens, and every day becomes incredible when you're recovering or you know, nicely boring, which is also a good thing. So yeah, and then everything started happening. This is 2006. Everything started happening. It was amazing, amazing, amazing. And I remember hosting this thing in one of the parks, and I was hosting Comedy Club. I was like 34. You know, really super confident. And at that age, I can say this now because I'm old, but super hot as well. Like when I was like in my early 30s, I think that's the hottest a woman is. Because you're confident and you're self-assured, but you still don't look out of place in a nightclub.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm enjoying about being 45 on Friday, is that I can go, oh, darling, when I was young, I really enjoyed my plump cheeks and my swagger.
Yeah.
And I just remember, and then this woman said to me afterwards, she goes, I just watched you, and I thought, it must be amazing to be her. And I remember thinking, yeah, mate, it is. It's fucking brilliant. It's brilliant. So then I had a lot of fun. And then I had...
So were most of your, like...
I was, like, tired.
So most of your 20s was sort of...
filled with anxiety.
Yeah.
And so I was...
Anxious about everything.
Everything. It was horrible. I would like lie awake at night worrying about something I'd said to someone at a party or just getting catastrophically drunk night after night after night. And that's why I'm like, I have no time for self-deprecation anymore, because I did it all. I sort of battered myself throughout my 20s and I will never ever do that again. And and so I thoroughly enjoyed my 30s, but I was... my career was going amazingly, and it looked like in my 30s it looked like I was really gonna become a household name. And then my husband left me.
Yeah.
And that was
What age? 30?
30. I was 36 by then.
So what was this, just as everything was kicking off?
Everything. I'd done my first live at the Apollo, I'd smashed it.
Yeah.
And I was on every panel show.
Yeah.
And then after that, after he and I broke up, I was completely... So it wasn't just my heart that broke, my world broke. The whole world changed shape.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to navigate it, and I couldn't give a fuck about my career.
Mm.
I didn't give a shit. I was making loads of money, like loads more than I make now. And I gave it like 10 grand I gave away to an ex-boyfriend. I just frittered money away.
Mm.
It meant nothing to me. Work meant no. I was on, I think I was on 8 out of 10 Cats. And my mum watched it. And she said, Shappy, you look like you're on another planet. And I remember Jimmy Carr came to me and asked me something about what they were talking about. And I didn't know what he was talking. I was daydreaming.
Yeah, yeah.
I was daydreaming on Cats.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, I'd kill to get on it now. I'm not booked on it anymore. I wouldn't kill to get on it now, but
yeah.
I am very aware that I just stopped getting booked because I would turn up to these things really lackluster and not know. Because I was just, I should have been in a dark room for a few years if I was sensitive.
Did you not take any time off? You just carried on?
I can say this now, but I left because I left them. You can edit this out anymore, but I don't think I was managed well.
Yeah.
I think it should have been recognised that I wasn't well. And I hear about other comics who went through a really bad time and their manager sort of plucked them out and went, you're not fucking going out in public. I think that should have happened to me. I should certainly not have done 3 live at the Apollos in a row.
Mm.
I was...
Why? Do you think like the quality wasn't very good?
The quality was... The quality... The first one was great, but because comedy is a moving iceberg, the jokes are very dated now.
Yeah.
Because it was like over 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And the other two, I don't even remember them. I don't even know my jokes that I did in them. I don't want to know. The quality was terrible because I wasn't writing. I wasn't present. I was utterly heartbroken. I was trying to... I thought I could get my husband back by... shouting at him all the time.
Yeah.
And I was going to court. I was having to like...
Yeah.
We spent 3 years in the court process of our divorce. And
3 years?
Yeah. Longer than we were married. It was awful. And so... Yeah. I would say that if... Looking back, someone should have gone, you are not fit for purpose at the moment.
Yeah.
Go to Thailand...
Yeah.
I don't know, go do some chanting somewhere, go do some yoga, go to a quiet place and just be silent and deal with this.
Yeah.
And I didn't do that. But then, you know what, maybe if they had, I wouldn't have listened.
Did you kind of feel like you didn't care about your career because you'd achieved everything you wanted to, like you'd had like a great few years and you'd achieved a lot?
No, I just didn't care about my career because I had... Oh, you're going to make me cry. I felt that I had lost the chance to have another child.
Yeah.
As well. So that dominated my...
Sure, yeah.
My thoughts, and that was more important than anything else. And I hadn't achieved everything I wanted to. I hadn't even begun.
Yeah.
But if I had been well, and if I had had, you know... I'm friends with my husband now, but we're very different people.
Yeah.
And if I had chosen... The thing is, I can't regret anything because I've got my boy, but I wasn't in a place to make the most of all my opportunities. Like I see people do now, and I think you're bloody amazing because you've got everything. You've got your balance right. You look after your mental health. And when you are kicking off and this career's going well for you, you have to look after your mental health.
Yeah.
You've got to be strong. And I know comics that when they started to do well, they stopped drinking.
Yeah.
Because they needed to be well and present for everything. And you see the fruits of that. It really works, being sober. But I was just plunged into booze and all my old addictions came back when I... when my marriage broke up, and I think I can't really call it a relapse because it went on for about 7 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, for about 7 years, I was a raging addict again in my 30s, which is kind of sad when I look back, but, you know.
Did you find success and money and fame and all of that stuff quite sort of toxic?
Like,
I know that you like obviously really enjoyed it, but did you find it bad for like, you know, your mental health? And
no,
because a lot of people find that quite a difficult mix of
I don't think I had enough of it for it to affect my mental health. I was really in the sort of like an early stage of getting somewhere. So I, you know, I'd done Life at the Apollo. I was doing the panel shows. I was selling out Edinburgh like a big 300-seater room. I was like, and I think what I thought was, this is it now. This is it. This is what I'm going to do. And it's always going to be selling out Edinburgh. It's always going to be asked to be the first to be asked to be on panel shows.
Yeah.
It's always going to be, but it's not. It's not. You have to, you really have to be present for it. And even if you are, you know, you have to accept that your face doesn't fit anymore. And nobody's owed a living on TV. And you have to accept that as well. So it wasn't all like, I'm so heartbroken, I'm gonna, you know, do, what else was it I did? No, it was Cats. It was 8 out of 10 Cats, where I was just, I remember I had a Iggle Piggle sticker on my leg. I had one of my kids' stickers. I hadn't even like...
What, in the recording?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just went, I thought, oh God, have I got a scab? Look, so I'm scratching my... I'm so detached from what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm having a little scratch. Yeah. and I hit the sticker. I'm like, what? And there's an Iggle Piggle sticker on my leg. I just thought, well, I'm on TV.
Yeah.
And I'm daydreaming. And I'm thinking about, well, I can't wait till this finishes because we can drink then.
Yeah.
Isn't that terrible? Or I'd sell out a show in Edinburgh. 300 seats, massive, brilliant, great show. The whole run sold out. And I would get halfway through my set and go, oh, fuck, just another half an hour before I can have a drink.
Yeah.
And it was all about getting off stage and going rampaging around Edinburgh.
Yeah.
That part of it, partying, drinking, was far more important to me than the hour. I put more energy into that than I did the hour that I was on stage. Isn't that sad?
Do you think that sort of looking back now was sort of... held you back at all?
Yeah, massively. Because, massively. Some people can do both. I couldn't.
But it hasn't held you back, you know, that much, because you're still doing really well and successful. And
oh, God, yeah, like I do. Now. But it's kind of weird, because the last three Edinburghs that I've done, I've really worked hard on the shows.
Yeah.
And when you think I've done about 13, that's pretty poor. I used to just turn up and go, guys, let's just have a laugh for an hour and I'm going
to
drink
it's
three...
It's enough to just see me.
Well, no, I'd go like, I'm going to drink three beers on stage because I feel like I'm being rock and roll, I'm being punk.
Yeah.
And I can't believe these comedians that take themselves so seriously.
Yeah.
And I'd get drunk during shows and think I was way funnier than I was.
I kind of think, I don't know, obviously I wasn't around back then, but it feels like...
No, you would
like...
have been at primary school.
Yeah, But it feels like comedy is maybe a bit more serious now than it used to be. And people, I don't know if it's a money thing. It must be a money thing. There's just more money involved. People come into it with a lot more focus and a lot more sort of career. They have people have career plans, my sort of contemporaries, and no one's really fucking around. And the people who are very quickly disappear.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I think possibly back... when you were starting, you could fuck around and be the biggest comedian. You can't really anymore because those people just...
It's become mainstream now.
By the wayside, those people.
Yeah, it's... that's where I remember seeing Sean Walsh and really loving him because amongst a sea of younger comics, he was the one that was the same as my generation.
Yeah.
Like, he was... he couldn't be anything other than a stand-up. Like, even if he got no money...
yeah, he'd still be a stand-up.
He'd still be a stand-up.
Yeah.
Whereas I think some of the others have options. But when I was a stand-up, like, I would not... there's nothing in the world other than stand-up for me. Like, there's nothing I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Nothing I could do. And you used to come up through the clubs, but now you come up through TV and radio.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the difference. And when I did it, even when I did it, because it started, I remember Jimmy Carr was the one that was the first comic that I met that was so businesslike about it. And, you know, Jimmy Carr and his famous Filofax.
Yeah.
Because Filofax was very sort of 90s and he would carry it around
was
everywhere.
Was that like a well-known thing?
Yeah, yeah. Jimmy Carr and his Filofax was a very well-known thing. And he would be so meticulous. and make little notes every single time he was on stage. He'd make notes about what he did. He wrote jokes, I remember, for a student sort of radio station thing, to get the practice in. And I remember once he sort of was talking to me backstage, going on about how, well, this is a recession-proof business. I was like, oh, Jesus, this is, I didn't even think of it like that. I'm happy for the, yeah, you know, if I get a tenner tonight, because that'll mean I can get a kebab on the way home.
Yeah.
And so he was really busy. And I remember once he said to somebody, Shappy would be really good if she had more focus. And that really hurt my feelings. I was like, yeah, oh, God, someone's seen the fact that I've got no fucking focus. And that was the thing. I remember back then when the internet was in its infancy, there was a site where people wrote comments about comedians, and someone wrote about me. So by this time I was about 26, saying that if she had a better work ethic, she'd be unstoppable. But at the moment, she's just coasting, yeah, on personality.
Yeah.
And that really hurt me because I know it's true.
Yeah.
And that's my worst flaw, is my focus. I've got no focus.
Not anymore though.
No, I've changed. Yeah. I know. Now it's different. It's different. So
Is it completely different now?
Completely different. Completely different. And that's why I feel like the glorious thing about our job is that you can always feel new.
Mm.
You know what we're talking about, being youthful. In stand-up comedy, you never feel sluggish about it, because at any point you can change yourself, you can turn things around for yourself, you can explore a whole new persona for yourself if you wanted to, and yeah, areas to talk about and emotions to bring to your act.
Yeah.
And so you always feel new, and that's what makes me think there's never a time when I'll not do stand-up, because
even if you sort of have like breaks from it, you'll always come back to it.
I'll get mad if I don't do, yeah, it for a while. Do you do that?
Yeah, I feel really weird if I don't gig for, I don't know, a week.
Yeah, yeah.
A week is a long time.
Yeah, it's like the lid coming off a pressure cooker.
Yeah, then I feel, yeah, it's like just having to release a valve.
Yeah,
it's
like, yeah.
You release
bloodletting, yeah.
Oh, I feel much better now.
I know, that's a disease.
Mad, isn't it?
It's a disease.
I think that is why people like tour until they die.
Yeah.
Because they just can't stop.
I don't want to do that. That's what I found out. That's what I properly accepted when I was on I'm a Celebrity.
Yeah.
I feel really silly saying what I learned, but I did, because yeah, I had no phone or internet for 3 weeks. I couldn't see or speak to not just my family, but anyone, any of my friends,
yeah,
or anyone that understood me, or anyone that was able to have any kind of nuanced conversation.
Yeah.
And then you look at your life and you just think, oh my fucking God, it's so brilliant. It's so precious.
Yeah.
It's so much fun. What on earth was I afraid of?
Yeah.
And so when I look back at my 20s and my 30s, it was utter fear. And perhaps it was fear of success. Perhaps that is it. Perhaps,
yeah,
it's like when you know yourself, comedians who are really successful, it's, you have to work so hard and be so obsessive about it to stay there. You know, to spin all those plates, you have to remain at the top of your game all the time.
Yeah.
And there's a cost to that. I think the cost is time with your kids.
Freedom, yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's any sort of shame, or I feel like people think there is shame in having huge success and then losing it, because It's mad to think you have to stay at the top of your game.
It's exhausting, yeah.
But, you know, footballers and tennis players have an amazing 5 years.
Yeah.
And then, of course they get... It goes down a,
yeah,
bit, because things change. And like, but there's nothing weird or wrong about that.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool when I talk to people and they were like the biggest comedian in the country in, I don't know, 1994.
Yeah.
And you talk to them and you know that during that time, they were the person in,
yeah,
the industry. There's nothing, it's not weird or bad. Or...
No, and also, you know, you can only introduce yourself to people for the first time once.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like with any industry, you know, not everyone can be Bono. Yeah. And not everyone could be Lee Evans.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But if you've had a bit of it and you've been able to shore yourself up a little bit financially and get enough people who like you to carry on seeing you on your tours, and you don't play 2,000-seater venues anymore, you play 200-seater venues, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's why, do you know, I've got this, I'm going to whisper this, because I've got this real pet hate. This is not pet hate, but I feel this sadness when comedians moan that they're not getting this, not getting that, not getting this telly thing, and I'm like, it's not about that though.
Yeah,
it's about the job.
Yeah,
and the job is the live audience. And sorry, I keep talking about this epiphany I had, you know, but other than that, I've always felt that my need to do stand up is sated by skipping out to Hard Bloody Hard Comedy Club in Chiswick on a Saturday night and doing a 20 minutes. That's the injection of excitement that I need.
Yeah.
And everything else is ego, and everything else is comparing yourself to other people. But at the core of it is that, oh, honestly, if I go out of my house of an evening, go into a comedy club that I love, knowing that there's going to be comics there that I'm friends with,
yeah,
I still get that real excitement, and I feel like exactly the same as when I was in my 20s and did that. You know what?
Minus the fear, though.
Do you know what? I'm being disingenuous. When I was in my 20s, I look back on all that time now, and I think a lot of people who have been through recovery do this. And it's a bit like being born again. Have you ever met anyone who's like a born again Christian?
Yeah.
And they make their life out before they found God to be so full of sin that actually it was probably just normal.
Yeah.
And I think I do the same thing about my 20s, because I did have an enormous amount of fun as well. But now that I'm in recovery and I take my work a lot more seriously, and I take the fact that people pay and come and see me really seriously, I can't even begin to tell you how seriously I take that, so I want them to have the best time possible.
Yeah.
So I did have fun, but I didn't have that clarity then, I guess. God, can you edit this out to make me sound less like a knob?
That's great. It's great.
Whenever I do podcasts, I get really serious and I get
People, I think, you know, because people always think that they're sort of going on, but it's not. It's the whole point.
Don't these look like boobs? Every single balloon.
Yeah. Shappy's table's covered in balloons.
Heart-shaped balloons that look like
tits. Yeah. We should probably wrap it up quite soon.
Yeah. Oh no, let's talk about something fun before we wrap it up. Can't just have me talking about had a breakdown after my divorce. I had a breakdown, proper, mental breakdown, and that is not the time to be on live at the Apollo. I can't even watch.
If anyone wants to check out Chappie's breakdown, I think it's all on YouTube, isn't it? It's basically all on YouTube.
It's all on YouTube.
Yeah.
The last live
at the Apollo. You look like you're having a breakdown.
No.
I've watched all those things.
Have you? I can't bear it. I can't bear it when people watch the last live at the Apollo I did. I was having a proper breakdown. I would have been crying before I went on stage. I remember that so clearly. I would cry before that. I was on tour as well, selling out everywhere, and I'd weep and weep and weep, dry my tears, put on makeup, go do the show, come off stage and cry again. And my brother used to drive me to my shows because I just cried all the time.
Yeah. That's awful, Shepherd.
It was awful. Do you know what, as well? I don't think I would have listened to anyone if they said don't do it.
Did the people around you know that you were crying all the time?
Don't think so.
Right.
No, I was quite good at hiding.
Surely someone must have been like, you shouldn't be doing this.
I don't know. I did a gig at Knock to Bag Comedy Club.
Yeah.
That's where I first met Sean Walsh, and I started crying, and he was only like, I don't know, 20 or something. You're right, I'm going to divorce, and he did this, and he said, I'm crying, and he's like he's not the most sort of demonstrative person it is, and he's like, right, okay. I looked at that and I was like, what the fuck?
I remember that you were telling me about that tour you did with John Richardson, where you would cry all the time and he didn't know how to handle it.
Poor John Richardson.
Yeah.
We did. Do you know what? We toured together. And it's a blur for me because all I did was cry.
Yeah.
And he would be brilliant and he would come off stage and he'd sit down and he'd write notes about where they lie, you know, all the show notes. And I'd just look at him and go, he's working hard on this show.
What nerd? He used to throw things at him.
I was like, I don't understand why we're not going out and getting really... I don't know why we're not getting really bladdered right now. God, yeah. I've got to wait for John to finish his fucking notes. And then I would cry.
Yeah.
And once, I was in... we were in Wales, at Pontypridd Theatre in Wales, backstage. Yeah. And I was crying. And he was there just... Really, it's not really fair on him because he's got a fucking show to do. You know, he's building a career here. He's like, so you're like, fucking hell.
Yeah.
And then while he was on stage, I bought a dog.
What do you mean? I was so depressed.
I thought you bought a dog? I thought I'm going to kill myself if I don't buy a dog.
Right.
I was properly like...
What, online?
Well, yeah, I didn't pay for it online. I spoke to this breeder.
During the show, backstage?
Yeah. And I called my brother, and I said... And he understood how I was feeling, because my family were all worried that I would kill myself. Like, it was that bad.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I've never said that out loud before, publicly, but I wanted to kill myself, but I couldn't, because I had a 2-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And I remember...
I thought you were going to say, because you had a tour.
You know what? If I was more ambitious...
Let me just get this Oxford day out of the way.
Oh, God, yeah, I wanted to kill myself. And I thought...
That's awful.
I needed an energy, because when my son was with his dad...
Yeah.
My house was just full of suicide.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I need to get a dog, otherwise, when my son's with his dad, I might kill myself, or my heart might just stop through pain. I just felt it would stop. And so...
Did you buy a dog?
I did get a dog, yeah.
Did you?
Beautiful doggy.
Did it help?
It helped a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, because dogs, again, they need you. They keep you in the present. You have to get out of bed if you've got a dog.
Yeah.
You know.
You've got cats now. Cats don't really give a shit, do they?
No, cats are amazing. But you know what? I have not revisited these dark years at all. But
sorry, this has been a bit like a therapy.
It has a bit. Can we do this again another time?
It's been good.
But it's, yeah, I remember that period when I was at that whole tour with John, I wanted to kill myself. Oh my God, and that's why I got a dog, because when my son was with his dad, that's all I did was obsess about suicide.
Yeah.
And I went to the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and I told my brother, I was like, yeah, I know that, we all know how that's how you felt, because my family were right in my face at that time. Like, no one left me alone. My neighbours were in, like, I was not left alone in that period.
Were you living around here?
No, I lived in sort of Putney Barnes way.
Okay.
But I had next door neighbours who are now, I'm still close friends with, and they would come and see me all the time. Everyone sort of looked after me a lot. Poor John Richardson. Even now when I see him, it's a bit awkward. All right, John, I don't cry anymore. John, I don't cry anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, that was terrible. Really bad times. Lovely chatting with you.
End the conversation on that. Thank you so much for doing it, though. It's great. Thank you.
Do you know I'm not going to be able to listen to this? You're going to put on Twitter here's my podcast with Shappy, and I'll block you.
I'll be like one of those reviewers.
But this is annoying because we have such a laugh together.
Yeah, but that's fine. This is great.
There we go, ladies and gentlemen. Shappy called Sandy. That was great. I love Shappy. She's incredible. So thank you so much to Shappy for coming on. If you're listening, Shappy. And as always, thank you to everyone who helps making the show. Joel Grove, who produces it. Will Shahada for editing it. And my manager, Rick Hughes, for all your help. That's it. We'll be back next week with another guest. We've got some cracking guests in the next few weeks. So keep listening. Subscribe to the show if you haven't already. Give it 5 stars. Tell your friends. And we will see you next week.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.